Hello, it's Heather and Christy. We've got something for you today that's a little bit different.
A little bit different, a little bit same.
I mean, you know what? It should feel comfortable and familiar, but completely different because the hosts are different.
Yeah.
It's a new podcast called Forgotten Fiction. It's
totally different content.
Yeah, it is an entirely different. So Forgotten Fiction, you're about to hear an episode. We may be biased because of the two hunks that host it, but this is a new podcast about books, films, TV, and other cultural artifacts that have gone overlooked or underrated. And it's hosted by, I think, two of our favorite all-time men.
Yeah. And luckily, they're also our husbands. It's hosted by Paris Brown and Tommy Brown, which, is there some relation there? Maybe. Who knows? We're all related on some level, right?
Yeah, we really are.
Each episode digs up pieces of media that have been lost to time and makes the case for why they matter.
Every episode is going to be different. That Paris doesn't know what Tommy's bringing. Mm-hmm. Tommy doesn't know what Paris is bringing. Paris always goes first. I think they were maybe going to switch it off, but they've hit a rhythm. So Paris goes first, and then Tommy will present his. And all I can say is that Nancy McKinney is a huge fan.
She loves it.
She doesn't just love the podcast. She just loves Paris and Tommy. So I think she, for her, it's like expanding the Sinisterhood universe.
Yeah.
So hopefully, much like my mom, who's a big fan, you're going to love the obscure horror paperbacks. They talk about childhood classics.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to recognize some of these names, but also it might be an edition of this that you didn't know, or film directors that you know, but you didn't know that they made this film.
Mm-hmm.
It's very fun to see the behind the scenes and have Paris be like, I don't think anyone's heard of this. So
yeah.
if it's been forgotten, they'll remember it for you.
I walked in yesterday and was like, are you watching? And I said the name of a friend we have that looks like Seth Green. And he was like, no, this is Monster Squad. I'm working. And I was like, okay. So now all of the Real Housewives of I'm working. I have to watch this for my job is now being used against me.
I was like, Paris, what are you watching? He's like, this is an obscure television pilot from the 90s. And I was like, I'm working. And I'm like, you guys figured out the Heather and Christy hack, which is to just make a show about what you love. So check out Forgotten Fiction. There's new episodes every Tuesday. And you can send Forgotten Fiction to them to the email address, forgottenfictionpod@gmail.com. They also have a Patreon that's free to join. And they post extra stuff on there as well and follow them on socials. But we hope you enjoy this episode. And also, it's like a behind the scenes. If you haven't met Tommy or Paris, or if you have, you can get to talk to them for very long. Now you can feel like you're the third person in a great lengthy conversation about some dope stuff that they dig up.
Well, both of us are looking for a third to introduce into our relationship.
Yeah.
So this works out great. Now we have so many thirds.
You are all our virtual thirds. So please, virtual thirds, enjoy. That's going to be the Forgotten Fiction podcast listeners. They're like, it isn't though. You all made that up.
The other third.
So we're calling him the thirds. Well, enjoy everybody. And go follow him and let us know what you think and let them know what you think, more importantly.
Yeah, enjoy.
Welcome to Forgotten Fiction. I'm Tommy Brown.
And I'm Paris Brown.
Some relation.
It's a some relation. Tommy,
yes.
How are you doing today, man?
I'm doing well. I'm operating on a huge lack of sleep because of children summertime antics, but that's been true for almost a decade, so it doesn't really... You shouldn't detect anything different, Paris.
You got that summertime... Madness. I don't know.
Madness.
Madness?
Ooh,
madness. See, that's the thing. This guy's an improv guy. He gets it.
Summertime madness. Yes. That's me, Tommy Brown, coming to you straight from summertime madness.
It is June here. So, yeah, it is the first week of that summertime madness. But you know what's good for summertime? For me, I love summer movies. I think we are in a great time for horror. As a matter of fact, I think there's like a lot of great movies that are out loud right now. What? You're smiling.
I just love that you're doubling down on the summer segue. After last week, you're like, I'm going after it again. Guys, it's summer. It's June.
I'm gonna hit it sooner or later. It's like it's a numbers game, man. I've got months to do this. Like I'm going to keep going back to the well until it finally hits. Thank you.
I love it. Let's do it.
Well, that is the thing. I think there is a lot of great summer movies. I think there's a lot of nostalgia that we have wrapped up, or specifically me, like wrapped up in summertime movies and going out to the movies and this thing. And it kind of dovetails into what I'm bringing for Forgotten Fiction this week.
All right, a summer blockbuster.
Well, actually, it's not a summer blockbuster. A summer lackluster. It is forgotten, and that is the reason why we're talking about it now. Tommy, let's talk a little bit about vampires, man.
Oh, yes. Well.
Yes, exactly.
Where do you want to start?
Oh, man. Well, we can go all the way back. Of course, we all know that the idea of the vampire in general has been around for a lot of interpretations over the centuries, right? There's the unholy, there's the disease carriers, sometimes there's spirits. They've gone through a lot of iterations, and there has been a big change, I would say, from like the previous like 1700s, 1600s lore of vampires that occurred with your boy in 1813, John Polidori.
That's right.
John Polidori, and this is kind of a throwback to one of our previous episodes, episode number something.
We won't put it in. We'll look it up right now. We're professionals.
We're professionals.
We'll find that exact episode. Paris.
Yes. Well, John Polidori, he really changed the vampire myth and found a defining characteristic that has gone on to define vampires in modern American culture and modern culture ever since. Something that separates vampires from the typical ghouls, the goblins, the ghosts of the night. Vampires, as we know them today, their defining trait, sexiness. I'm just saying, vampires, sexiness is the thing. Vampires, as we know them, the thing that really separates them is they've got to have aura. They have to have aura to really be the vampires. I think Polidori kind of explored this with the whole gothic like romance and all that other stuff. Mm-hmm. We see that sometimes in like, from your Twilights to your Draculas to everything, a vampire has to have some swag.
Yeah, as we laid the groundwork for in episode 2.
So vampires have to have aura, right? Mm-hmm. And in the 1980s, vampires films, of which there are many, including The Lost Boys, there are none, in my opinion, truly, that encapsulate the pure mystique, the alluring nature of living outside of society, and the open road endless nights, quite like 1987's vampire western Near Dark.
Nice. Yeah, as soon as you said open road, I was like, oh, okay.
You remember this from being on tour with Sinister Head, Tommy?
No.
Okay, so in one of the nights, so Sinister Head, we did this bit when we were on tour a little while ago for Full Moon Energy, where every night we'd find like different, you know, ghouls and goblins or some kind of different, monster from that specific local city. And I can't remember where we were, if we were in Houston or San Antonio, but at one point in time, the ladies pulled up an image of Bill Paxton as a vampire. That is from the film Near Dark.
I do remember it from the show. I thought you were, because we also would pick a random horror movie to watch at the hotel a lot. And I was like, I don't remember watching that. But yeah, I remember it being part of their show.
We did not actually watch it at a hotel. To my knowledge, we have never watched it because I, for the first time, watched it. And the reason why we, Tommy, that we have never watched this movie is it is so damn hard to find.
Okay. I didn't know this.
I've got to explain how forgotten this movie is.
Yeah, tell me your journey.
Yes, it's notoriously difficult. All right, so first of all, Near Dark, 1987's Near Dark film, is not streaming on Netflix or Prime or Apple TV in America. It appears on streaming sometimes sporadically, often during Halloween, much like the ephemeral creatures of the movie itself. See, the thing is, this is an older film, an indie film, and the rights are often in flux. So you're like, okay, probably you could find it on DVD. Here's the thing. only sometimes. The film has been out of physical media print for years now. So you could find it sometimes online, sometimes it's like through secondhand, only some people have it. I was able to see a couple different DVD copies, and they range from like $16 to like $28, and the Blu-rays will set you back somewhere between $99 and $129. Oh, wow.
I got to get you the number to my Beavis and Butthead guy. I bet he's got it somewhere. You know what I mean?
See, if you got a guy, you got a guy. That is the thing. Yeah. That is the best way, because it is so, so difficult. So I actually went on a process because I was like, oh, I really want to talk about Near Dark. And the more, you know, you ever have it where like the more difficult it is to find something, the more you're like, well, now I've got to do this
thing. Yeah, absolutely. That's the most relatable thing I've ever heard. Yes.
Yep. So to our listeners, much like the vampiric outlaws of the film, if you want to watch this film, you might have to get creative. But is it all worth it?
Any search for lost media is going to be worth it when you find it, even if it sucks.
You know what I'm saying? It makes it the chase makes it all that much better, because like I really went through it for this. But the thing is, so when I was first doing my research for this episode, I saw something. It was a content creator, and they had a thumbnail on their video talking about Near Dark. And they asked, is it better than Lost Boys? And I was like, man, this is some clickbait. Like, you know what I'm saying?
This is apples and oranges. I already know it.
You know what I'm saying? So I was like, oh, okay. It's a clickbait thing of like, is it better than Lost Boys? And I did watch it.
Yeah.
And I will say, everyone's opinion is going to vary. Lost Boys obviously holds a very special place in a lot of people's hearts. But I can say that I, after watching the film, no longer believe that that image was clickbait. I think there is some substance to what she is saying, that this film does actually rival Lost Boys.
Paris, it's been a while.
Thanks.
It's been a while since I've seen the movie, so I'm just going to come right out and ask. does Near Dark feature the song Cry Little Sister?
Okay, so what so? So the Near Dark does have a soundtrack by Tangerine Dream.
Okay.
Really good band, really cool synthy things that has the vibe.
Yeah.
But I will give it. Soundtrack is better. It just is. The soundtrack for Lost Boys is better. There's impartially, it is better.
So that's,
you can't touch that.
Yeah, that's almost insurmountable.
Insurmountable.
But tell me more.
Okay. So let me tell you a little bit about Near Dark, 1997's Near Dark. Let me give you a little bit of a teaser of the synopsis, all right? So the film opens as the sun goes down along the Texas-Oklahoma border. And I'm already invested because I'm like, oh, cool. This takes place. I know this kind of area, right?
Yeah.
Our Stetson hat-wearing, pickup-driving protagonist, Caleb, notices the young and beautiful drifter named May eating an ice cream cone. Caleb's out for a night in the town, and he's kind of like, you know, he notices this woman, May, and he swaggers up to her, and he asks her if he could have a bite of her ice cream cone. She's like, oh, a bite? Oh, okay, all right. And she says that she's staying with some friends, and she needs a ride home. You've seen this, right? Mm-hmm. And from there, you can imagine that Caleb breezes through so many red flags as he takes this beautiful girl, May, home. She has a strange fixation with the night. She's talking all kinds of weird stuff. She mentions that she'll still be around when the light from this distant star finally reaches us. It's like
normal.
Caleb's
normal flirting.
Totally normal. Caleb introduces her to her horse, and her horse is definitely afraid of her. It's like, or his horse is definitely afraid of her. And it's like, no, that's not a red flag at all. No, it's like, she literally scares animals.
Never bring home a woman who your horse is afraid of. That's an old proverb.
That's an old Texas saying. Never do that. But as you can imagine, after their brief evening and time together, Caleb is left with a bite on his neck. And as the sun rises, he discovers that the sunlight causes his skin to burn, something terrible, right?
Yeah.
Shortly thereafter, May and her aforementioned group of friends scoop up Caleb into a blacked out RV and take him away into a new life full of dark roads. So that's how the film starts.
I love it. It's very rock and roll.
It is. It's got a lot of rock and roll. It's got a lot of outlaw. There is the, it feels very on location. So it is gritty. Remember previously we were talking about it's like the best films to watch on VHS?
Yeah.
Lost Boys made that list. I would say this one is another one that it's like, oh man, if you could ever find a VHS copy, if you could find any copy, kudos to you.
Nice.
But if you could find a VHS copy of this, because it's so indie, it has that kind of grittiness to it. It has that texture as they're going on location in all these different Texas roads. Mm-hmm. It has a beauty to it, right? So let me back up a little bit and give a little context first.
Okay.
I wanted to cover this film because this past week, I don't know if you saw, but I mentioned the film editor Marcia Lucas passed. Mm-hmm. She was the editor for Star Wars and an editor for many other Hollywood films. And she really had a huge impact on Star Wars in terms of like changing the third act and really like making it much more impactful, especially for like the Death Star sequence that a lot of people didn't know about. And she kind of like went unsung. She was like George Lucas's editor and his wife as well. But she passed this week. And that got me thinking that, you know what? I have not featured yet on Forgotten Fiction a movie that was directed by a woman.
Okay. For shame. So she directed it as well. You said she was the editor?
No.
Oh, so she was you're an just editor. Saying you're doubling down on your shame.
Yeah, I'm doubling down on my shame by mentioning that a different female editor died this week. This is not her.
Okay.
Sorry, I can see how that could be confusing.
No, thank you, Paris. Okay. I did see a video, and I don't know if it's related to this, but Patton Oswalt was doing a stand-up set, and it was filmed, and he was talking about male directors, like, just like going out there with all their cameras and just pointing and shooting at everything and just like, like they're firing a machine gun and this like having hours and hours of footage and just being like, okay. And then handing all that over to a woman and being like, find a story in there.
Absolutely. Yeah. So like that happens a lot. I think you sent me that video. Okay. I feel because I've seen that video and I'm pretty sure you sent it to me.
Okay.
But yeah, much like Sally Menke also was Quentin Tarantino's editor. There's been a lot of female editors who have gone unsung and unnoticed throughout the years. But this woman who directed Near Dark is not a traditional editor by like craft, even though she does have a lot of association with James Cameron. And that's kind of like one of the her entrees into the business. Her name is Kathryn Bigelow, who directed Near Dark. Kathryn Bigelow.
I've seen her name around. Sorry.
Kathryn Bigelow is... No, it's all right. Kathryn Bigelow is... You would see her name around because she's the first woman to ever win an Academy Award for directing a feature film.
What was it?
That one was... Ooh, boy.
Let me put you on the spot.
Was it The Hurt Locker or was it Zero Dark Thirty? I'm going to say it was Zero Dark Thirty.
That's where I know the name from. Okay.
I like both those films.
Oh, they're so good. Point Break.
Yeah, she did that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. An amazing talent.
She is an amazing talent. She has like a fantastic eye. And the thing about this one is this was her first solo directorial feature. It was Near Dark in 1987. And the thing that makes Bigelow kind of different is, you may not know this, but Bigelow actually comes from a painting background. She was always an artist, but she comes from like a really painterly type of way of looking at things. And in an interview, she said, talking about Near Dark, she's like, I want the nights to be very seductive. And let me tell you, they are. This film has a vibe that was crafted specifically. You could tell it was in the hands of a visionary because the film, for example, was shot in just 47 days, but 40 of them were night shoots. And she used a lot of this technique called chiaroscuro lighting. If you're not familiar with it,
I'm not.
It is a lighting technique that was pioneered. So it was pioneered originally by a lot of painters. So like Rembrandt used this, Caravaggio used this. And the phrase is literally two Italian words and it means light and dark. Chiaro meaning light and scuro meaning dark. And what it does is use a lot of like light and shadow together. As a matter of fact, for anyone who may be watching, but you can see like our faces are kind of like mostly lit, and then there's a dark background to us. So for other examples, for Theater of the Mind, if anyone knows the painting, like The Girl with the Pearl Earring, mm-hmm. if you can imagine that, that has her face on it, but also like she falls off into this darkness around her. Mm-hmm. And that really influenced a lot of Near Dark, because there's a lot of close-up of faces that are lit by like a single light source, and then everything around them is dark. She made the shadows very alluring. The shadows were something that was like really calling to you throughout this entire movie.
I'm glad you made it out alive, Paris.
I almost got sucked in. I was like, I mean, I'm in Texas. So I'm just like, I just walked out to the stars and I was like, oh man, they're right there. I could just go onto this, these dark nights.
See Paris what happens, has been man. Looking at RVs. It's
like, he's just going to throw it all away. He's just going to go into RVs and just, oh man. Yeah. But there are a lot of shots of like backlit cowboys in the night, because this is a vampire Western, which is one of the things that kind of got it off the ground, because she originally wanted to make a Western film. And at the time, they're like, well, Westerns aren't really like selling right now. Vampire films are really what's up. And she's like, all right, yeah, I'll throw some vampire stuff into it. And she really leaned into that. But the fascinating thing is her vampires are really mysterious in this. There aren't any like references to garlic or crosses or silver. They don't even really have fangs. And the cool thing about it, Kathryn Bigelow was quoted as saying, she said that she endeavored to almost invent our own mythology. We eliminated the crosses, the garlic, the stakes, the silver bullets, and tried to keep it understandable and as accessible as possible. It was the metaphor they were after with the consequences of love and attraction. Pretty grave consequences, is what she said.
Interesting.
It's a cool bit. It's I like a Texas shot kind of vampire Western. I don't know if you've ever seen John Carpenter's Vampires.
Yeah, but wow, that just unlocked a memory.
Did it?
Yeah, that's another one I haven't seen in forever. That's another grandma's shelf.
Yes, that was in the 90s. That was after Perfect Dark, John Carpenter's Vampires. But it had that same vibe of like really badass, kind of like much like From Dusk Till Dawn, that also like vampires in the West wasn't a really big thing until like, you know, the 90s. It kind of like took off a little bit more. But 87, this was a really different kind of idea of the vampire Western. But the thing about it is, that made it different was the consequences of love and attraction that you talked about, right? Simon, let's talk a little bit about romance. The other thing that sets Near Dark really apart from Lost Boys is it has a real emphasis on romance. There's a quote at one point in time between Caleb and his lady May much later on in the film, where she asks him, it's like, do you miss the day? And he kind of turns to her and he says, nah, I could see better at night. It's like, okay, a little smoothie. All right,
Well, but I mean, I must remind you, there's a romance in Lost Boys as well.
Yeah, okay, what would you say is the romance in Lost Boys, Tommy? If we're making the claims here.
No, I'm just kidding. It's more like a teenage, it's more like a teenage crush and a seduction.
Yeah, I thought you were gonna say with the. I was like, yeah. With the Coreys or what's it's. I guess
well, the older brother. Well, the older the bringing in of these kids into the vampire community of what was it, Santa Clara or wherever they were.
I think it was Santa Clara. I just recently watched Lost Boys. Like I don't know.
Okay,
a couple weeks ago.
So yeah, you know, he's like enamored with this vampire and follows her into that community, basically. Mm. So he's kind of chasing after his own May, if you will.
He kind of is. But I would also I'd say that's more Kiefer Sutherland's, like the one of that thing. You know?
No, for sure. That's why I said it was more like a teenage crush and like seduction game than a romance. So the exception proves the rule.
No. For all of our Lost Boys fans, there's some Lost Boys people who are listening right now. They're like, "Grr! How dare you like besmirch Lost Boys?" I'm coming around to some good points about it.
Yeah, but in Near Dark does not have the Coreys.
There are no Coreys in this movie. I will tell you what it does have though. It's got some good romance. I'll get back to it. So there was also a scene later on in the movie where they're not the only couple. So Caleb and May are not the only couple in this movie. And that's what kind of makes it a little bit cool. There's another couple with Jesse Hooker, who's played by Lance Henriksen, and Diamondback. And they're driving one night during like a long and lonely road. And they pass by this kind of overpass area. And Diamondback, the woman of the group, she's like, she turns to Jesse and she's like, I knew, it's like, do you remember that? That's where you first turned me. And she's like, I knew you were trouble when you first saw you. He says, how many years ago was that now? And he's like, I don't know. And they just kind of like hold each other in their hands as they're driving. And it's just like this really small, like romantic thing of like this couple that's been around for a really long time, which you don't see in a lot of, especially not in Lost Boys, but you never really get the romanticized version of a couple who's just driving through all of these nights together, you know?
Yeah, usually it's the like the apathy of the centuries and stuff like that that comes through.
Which, getting back to that, it makes me wonder, because we played this game at one point in time. I had to ask, I think I wrote this down once. Tommy, how long do you think you could keep a vampire coven going, right? Like a group of like five or six like tight-knit vampires, like y'all are all down. How many centuries? Because usually there's going to be some drama that pops off.
Yeah. You know how it is, you know? Centuries? Man, I don't know. I think centuries... I think maybe we romanticize how well that would go, because just based on improv troops I've been in.
Right. I was just thinking, I was like, they are a tight, you're a tight knit group.
Yeah.
You guys share similar interests and you're together all the time. Like, I was like, sooner or later, like you're something's going to be weird.
Absolutely.
There's going to be relationships and there's going to be drama. There's, you know, that's what people do.
Yeah. Yeah. You almost form through like a blood bond in an improv troupe, and then everyone, like, there's an unspoken rule that no one's gonna break up the troupe or leave or anything, and that lasts until somebody wants to, and then they do, and then everyone remembers that we're just, you know, we're just humans. We're not vampires. Just humans.
I mean, you're both very theatrical. There's a lot, you know, there's like a lot of like specific verbiage. I don't know, man. Yeah. I don't know.
No. We don't. I don't think we get any closer to vampires than theater kids.
You know, that's true. Even the theater kids try. They try.
Yeah, sure, we are. Absolutely.
Well, speaking of theater kids, let's talk a little bit about this cast. This cast, when we talk about the aura of the vampires that is really permeating, that's what I want to really get across, that aura is so well in Perfect or in Near Dark. And you can't have swagger without good actors. So, Kathryn Bigelow, as we discussed briefly, she had, at this time, a friendship with James Cameron. They eventually would get married, and they eventually later on after that get divorced, but they like knew each other really, really well. And as she was casting this, Cameron had just made Aliens. And Cameron was like, yo, I've got a lot of good actors from Aliens to like, for you to use in Near Dark. And so she did. She auditioned them and they worked out really well. One of them, of course, is Lance Henriksen, who he was the android in Aliens.
Yeah.
And you've seen him. He's been in a lot of different stuff. Another one was Jeanette Goldstein, who famously played Private Vasquez Aliens. Even though she is not Latino, Jeanette Goldstein is very much not Latino, but she did play Private Vasquez and played a real, she, I mean, you know, it was a good role, but yeah, that was one of those things I was like, ugh, looking back on it. She's in it.
Her IMDb page says she's a true chameleon. So,
oh yeah, yeah.
I think if you're a true chameleon, it doesn't matter.
That's a good spin. Yeah, she is a chameleon as Natchez. Well, in this one, she is not. She is playing a, to my knowledge, a white woman named Diamondback, and of course, the aforementioned Bill Paxton as Severin. Man, oh man. Oh, also, Joshua John Miller. Shout out to Joshua John Miller, who plays the character of Homer in this vampire group. There is one of them who is like an 11-year-old boy. So this was like prior to Anne Rice's the Interview with the Vampire. Not the book. This is prior to the movie adaptation. So the idea of like a kid vampire was still, I would say, in the American lexicon. But it wasn't seen on the big screen that much.
Yeah.
Before this kid named Homer. So he's part of like that vampire crew that we talked about briefly.
Yeah.
But let me tell you, man, Bill Paxton. Oh, gosh. He has this outlaw vibe where he swaggers into every room like he's bad and they know he's bad. Like he's having so much fun in the role. It's wild.
Nice.
And of course, RIP to the late, great Bill Paxton. I want to throw out some of the lines that he says as they are burning one of their burner vehicles. There's like all this flames around him. And Bill Paxton turns to one of the other vampires and he's like, hey, Jesse, remember when we started that fire in Chicago? She's just a very fun little, yeah. I'm just like, oh, that's a, he, and he does a lot of good bits. Some of them are actually improvised. I don't want to give away every good line, but he does a lot of great ones. But you can kind of see it in, there's a scene at one point in time where he's hitchhiking, and this isn't giving it away because there's so much hitchhiking in this movie. It really, I'm just like, 1980s, man, everyone was hitchhiking. There's, it's like, yeah. A thing for these vampires.
Well, it's like reverse drive-through window, right? Instead of getting in line at a drive-through for food, you're just standing next to the road with your thumb out waiting for food to come by.
I'm telling you, that's exactly it. Patent that. That's perfect. Because Bill Paxton, at one point in time, he's standing out with his thumb out, and these two ladies pick him up, and I was just like, don't do that. But he has this vibe and this aura that's like, kind of dangerous, kind of playful. I mean, like, he's kind of, you know, he's smiling. He's like, I'd like to buy you two ladies a drink. And you know, and yeah. He's got it.
He's a Texas road dog.
You know, man.
Woof, woof.
It seemed like a horrible idea, but not out of the realm of possibility.
Wow. It seems like a perfect casting, for sure.
It was. Such good, perfect casting. Let's pivot to the time period, because this was... came out in 1987. So this movie came out at a fascinating time in American culture, but I thought about it. And we've talked before about horror looking at horror from an archaeological perspective, kind of like the things that were the subconscious fears of society at the time often make their way into horror films. And we've seen that with like some of the demonic scares of like the 1960s and 70s, because there was like a lot of the Manson family. Then later the 70s, there was a lot of like crime stuff. So we saw a lot of like crime films and fears about that. And that led into like the 1980s with like serial killers and slashers. There was like a feminist backlash. A lot of that stuff all comes into play in the horror genre. So if you recall, in 1980s, there was a big vampire revival. So 1985, Fright Night, Life Force, and Once Bitten all came out in the same year.
Yeah.
And Once Bitten was with Jim Carrey, for those who might not remember.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But then after that, so those hit at the box office. People were like, oh, okay. I mean, Fright Night was a big deal. Life Force was like an alien vampire film. Not as well, but you know. And then Once Bitten was a comedy vampire film. So after that, there was the 87-88 wave, which included Lost Boys, Near Dark, Monster Squad, Vampire's Kiss with Nicolas Cage, and My Best Friend's a Vampire. So this was like happening often. Vampire films were really, really big during that time. And the other thing that happened during that time was there was a fear that emerged that dealt with blood and sex, and it was mysterious and terrifying. And I want to quote Kylo Patrick R. Hart, who was a media analyst. He said that by 1985, independent films and documentaries pertaining to AIDS started to emerge, along with the NBC network's first made television movie about AIDS. So this is now making its way into the American culture. And I would posit that had a little bit of an effect on vampire popularity.
For sure. For sure. The blood, the fear.
The mysterious stranger that, you know, like can change your life in the course of just one night. Like that whole stuff, I think that permeates in the culture.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the reasons why vampirism kind of was like, ooh, you know, vampirism. Near Dark really leans into this and doesn't really shy away from this. There is this fear of it being a disease that this person, Caleb, is contracting from this beautiful girl that he meets one night. So it's a really like... fascinating meta narrative as well. And also there's the whole thing of like, once he goes on this journey, like going on this journey of like the outlaw, the outsider journey, you're in the dark, there's a lot of like leather jackets and everything. So now you're on the outside group. So there's all those other cultural iconographies that come into Near Dark that I think make it a better textual analysis than a lot of the more popcorny vampire films of the time. Like this one's really saying something about our culture and really trying to like get into stuff.
Fine. Fine, Paris. Yes, Lost Boys is popcorny.
Well, let's break it down into one of my final things of is it better than Lost Boys? According to one Paris Brown who watched it, do I think it's better than Lost Boys? Let's get into the context. The film came out on October 2nd, 1987, in only 262 theaters, had a $5 million budget. It was much more of a low-budget indie fare.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about that is that Lost Boys came out in 1,500 theaters only 2 months prior. So like during that time, Lost Boys would have still been in the theaters. Yeah. Like, and also people have just seen like this big cultural phenomenon vampire film. So that's one of the reasons that this one kind of got buried a little bit.
Mm, interesting.
And yeah, yeah. It again, it got forgotten.
Forgotten.
Terrible. All right. thank you. So the New York Times, Karen James wrote at the time, and I don't particularly agree with this review, but he wrote that Miss Bigelow's two studied compositions, Caleb in silhouette riding a horse toward the camera, clash with the understudied approach to the character's looks. So it didn't get great reviews at the time, but later in 2007, one Jim Hoberman of The Village Voice wrote that Bigelow has made bigger movies than Near Dark, but none better, calling it a poetic horror film that draws its power from the outlaw mythology of Bonnie and Clyde and Gun Crazy, or maybe the Manson family, and its brooding loneliness from the Western landscape. Nothing I've seen in the 20 years since Near Dark appeared successfully Americanized the myth of the vampire.
That is a good point, though. I mean, what's more American than a Western, you know?
It is. It is such a Western thing. And I think that she was able to turn that on its head, again, drawing from the cultural things that are happening at the time of like the fear of AIDS, and then bringing back all of these things that we've seen from like the Outsiders, from like a lot of like the Bonnie and Clydes and all those things, they're going on the run films that really lend itself to the idea of leaving your past life for a world of darkness, you know, and like outsiderness and outlaw mentality. All of that stuff is so true. So all I'd say 100 to that review. It is very, very similar. And like to even give like another scene talking about Bigelow's great acumen at directing, and, you know, mild spoiler, you can skip ahead if you don't want to hear it, but like later on in the film, there is a shootout scene, as you happen with a lot of Westerns. And the shootout is like happening in the vampire's den, but the danger doesn't come from the guns because guns don't really affect them. But in every single shot that is made, a bullet hole creates a beam of a shaft of light. That is the true danger to these mm-hmm. vampires as it's going on. So like that kind of like really clever stuff of like, yeah. That's like taking it and like, oh, that's elevating it. That's like elevating these two different disparate mm-hmm. genres into one really cool thing that comes together.
Yeah, nice. And sets the stage for From Dusk Till Dawn to do that later.
You know what I'm saying? From Dusk Till Dawn, much later. Exactly. This came out before From Dusk Till Dawn.
Yeah.
One of my favorite things, and this is, I wrote this down, but like I have a lot of different favorite Tarantino quotes, but I think my favorite one was at the end of From Dusk Till Dawn, whenever Cheech Marin finally shows up and like he's like, you know, oh, what were they, psychos or something? And right, you may remember this.
Yeah.
But my boy's like, he's like, psychos? You think there were psychos? Psychos don't explode when sunlight hits them. I don't give a fuck how crazy they are. And I just love that line yeah. so much in the timing of the movie and everything like that. So anyway, but I'm a big fan of From Dusk Till Dawn. Not as forgotten, but it's fun.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But that's a cool, you know, concept of the shootout being the creating the shafts of light and that being the danger.
It is.
Nice.
It is. It is a danger. So what do I think? I think, all right, so from soundtrack still goes to Lost Boys. Yeah. Even though the synthy score of Tangerine Dream, which was also used in a lot of like Michael Mann films at the time, really lend itself to this kind of like ephemeral vibe of the vampires and the open road and all that stuff. Like Tangerine Dream really kind of makes it in a 1980s like synthy style.
Mm-hmm.
Really great soundtrack. But I would say from the characterization and story, I got to give the edge over to Near Dark. I will say, though, the final third of the film does get a little bit cheesy, so I have to take some points off from that. Yeah. And overall, I would say, man, I would go back to Near Dark gets a little bit of an edge for the story and the characterization and the fact that it could be a little bit of like, oh God, what's that Rob Zombie film?
Which one?
It's after House of a Thousand Corpses. It's the sequel to House of a Thousand Corpses. You know what I'm talking about?
Where
they're on the road.
Three from Hell?
No, Three Lords from Hell is Salem. No, it's before Lords of Salem. I don't think
Devil's
it was
Devil's Rejects.
No. The Devil's Rejects. Yes. It has a
don't
lot
worry,
of those
I'm gonna,
things.
I'm going to clean that up with some editing. Don't worry.
Thank you. So it has a lot of like Devil's Rejects vibes. And if it had the Devil's Rejects kind of ending, I would be like, oh, this is better than Lost Boys, like 1,000%. Because Devil's Rejects ending was so good. And if it had that, that would be the thing to put it over the edge. But because it doesn't have that, because of some third act stuff, I can't quite say it's better than Lost Boys, but it is a contender. It is a strong contender and so very worth actually tracking down and finding it because it is such a different type of vampire film and it's so artistically directed by a truly good artist. So for that reason, it is forgotten fiction that you should definitely check out.
That's awesome. Thank you for bringing that. And you heard it here first, folks. Paris thinks that Rob Zombie's a better director than Catherine Bigelow.
It's like after all that, it's like I did all that stuff. It's like I haven't talked about a female filmmaker in a long time.
If only they could have got a man to do it.
just at the end. And then they're like, no.
I'm just kidding.
Epic. And for the record, I do think that she is better than Rob Zombie, just so we can put that on the record. No shade to Rob Zombie. I think Rob Zombie's good. Well, that's a story for a different thing. We can talk about Lords of Salem.
Yeah, we don't have time. That's our different podcast. That's our running theme. We don't have time for that.
We'll cut that in the next one. But yes, Johnny, I highly recommend it. It's a good summer watch. I'm going to dovetail summer and everything.
Yeah. Until it's not summer anymore. I can't wait for next. I can't wait for fall.
Oh boy. Oh, you think I don't have stuff for fall?
Oh, I know you do. That's why I can't wait. What fiction is more forgotten than the stories that predate writing? The stories that live in our blood and our DNA. The stories that got us here and created a foundation for everything creative that we know and love today. In fact, the book I'm bringing today knows that more than almost anything else published for children. Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark by Alvin Schwartz, which, by the way, was published in 1981. I thought it was a 90s baby.
I did think so, too. I guess it didn't catch steam until later on.
Yeah, Paris, tell me your relationship with this book. You have one because we all have one.
Don't we all? I came into love of this book series probably during the Scholastic Book Fair. I think it's actually the first time I would have seen it, much like many of our listeners. But the thing that always draws you in is that cover, those covers and the artwork that still you can remember vividly. And you're like, oh my gosh, once you saw that cover from across the way, it's like, you part the seas and you're like, oh wait, what is that book? And you pick it up and you hear these very, or you read these very like interesting dark tales that are like, okay, all right. Even the text is a little bit weird. It has a vibe. It felt like you truly found something when you found Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark.
And you did. I mean, when I say we all have a relationship with this book, what I mean is we all have two relationships with this book, the stories and then the artwork, because they were two very different sides of the same coin.
This one is one that you can judge the book by its cover.
Yes. And so today I want to start with the author, Alvin Schwartz. He was born in April of 1927 in Brooklyn. He was the son of a taxi driver. He later was a Navy veteran. He got his bachelor's degree from Colby College and a master's in journalism from Northwestern. Then he spent a few years as a newspaper reporter. But in 1963, he quit his steady job and converted his shed in the backyard into an office. Not to become a horror author for children, not to peddle death, cannibalism, and Satan to grade schoolers, but he became a folklorist, a collector, and arranger of folk stories, rhymes, and silliness for kids, which he compiled into more than 50 books. Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark was curated by him. There are 5 pages of notes on the folk roots of the stories, and then 6 pages of sources for every story and poem in the book, which oral tradition, which religion, which region and culture the story came from. And then there are 3 pages of straight bibliography information, telling what books he found some of the stories in. This is more a textbook than it is a horror book. This is academic scholarship dressed up as a children's paperback. And I don't think we really noticed that back in the book fair.
I didn't notice that at all. Was that like in the book?
Yeah. Yeah. After the last story, there's 3 different sections of sources, notes, and bibliography that talk about, you know, which region of the United States, which tribe, like which culture this came from. The roots of this story go back to Ireland. Like, it's not his original work to the point that I think most children assumed.
Not at all. Like, because as you mentioned, I was like, oh, yeah, I think vaguely I remember that they had those, like, sources and text. But, like, now I'm like, oh, yeah, that's what I really want to check. I mean, it's like Pearls Before Swine. I'm like, oh, had I known, I would have definitely been like, oh, this is way more interesting.
It's very cool to revisit. I had a lot of fun seeing it through that lens this time. Mm-hmm. So Schwartz died of lymphoma on March 14th, 1992. While the efforts to ban his books were at their peak.
Why?
His daughter said, my dad was very proud that the books were being banned because he thought it meant the books were relevant. Alvin was only one half of the equation, though. We have to talk about the illustrator, Stephen Gammell. His art style and illustrations for this book created the dreamscape for an entire generation's nightmares. They were iconic. They are iconic. They have sharp edges and splatter and bleed across the page. They hold nothing back. The artwork is the horror in this book.
It is. And it's like such a specific style that, I mean, at the time I didn't really see anywhere else. And I think that was like the very wispy, like pencil work and like the ghosts that almost disappear into the page.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
You know, like, that was so cool.
The illustrations seem to bleed from within the page almost. It's very, very cool. Stephen Gammell was born in February of 1943 in Iowa. His father was an art director for a major magazine. And Gammell's entirely self-taught. He doesn't give interviews. There's almost no personal information about him anywhere on the internet. On his Wikipedia page, down in the bottom, there's an external link to the biography of Stephen Gammell on the Harper Teacher website. When you click that link, you get a landing page with no information other than the message, oops, looks like you've reached the end of the chapter.
What?
It's
talk about lore.
Yeah. He's so private that when the 2019 documentary about these books was made, he declined to participate. Instead, his words in that documentary are from a rare print interview, and they were read aloud on camera by someone else. In his email to a family member asking on the director's behalf, Gammell wrote, I'm like Bill Watterson of Calvin and Hobbes, who essentially disappeared to move on. I admire that, and I do likewise. And that's all he had to say about participating in the documentary.
Bro, talk about building an entire legend and reputation of just like, no, this is my work. Yeah. I don't need to talk about it. This is what it is. I put it out there. And it's something cool to be able to put work that does permeate so many of our like subconscious and like our nightmares. And the fact that he's like, that's it. That speaks for itself. I don't need to, you know, take any credit. That's wild.
Yeah. I think there's a feeling that come from the drawings. Like, it's almost like these drawings were standalone. I didn't have that much to do with them. You know what I mean? They're like, they speak for themselves, but also they stand alone and created themselves. This kind of a feeling that I think a kid could get looking at these. No one's looking at those pictures and thinking about Stephen, you know, when they're 10 years old.
That's true.
In 1989, 8 years after Scary Stories, Gemmell won the Caldecott Medal, the most prestigious award in children's book illustration, and he won it for a book called Song and Dance Man, a warm, joyful story about a grandfather who used to be a vaudeville performer. His illustrations make books legendary, especially the Scary Stories series. What else makes them legendary? How about the title Most Banned Books of the 90s? Or number one on the American Library Association's Most Challenged list for the same decade.
Metal.
These books these books spent 19 consecutive years on that list.
Dude, that is – I mean, that is – like the author said, it's like it means that they're irrelevant. It's like the fact that it's on this banned list. It's like, hey, my work is relevant. People care. It is, and especially for a scary book, the fact that it's like this is too much for people, that is quite an honor.
Yeah. The reasons parents gave for challenging the books, they're too morbid for children, occult and Satanism, an unrealistic view of death, violence, and my personal favorite, might cause children to fear the dark.
Put it on a cover, man. That is awesome. Like, it's like, that's right, might cause children to fear the dark. You better believe it.
Parents showed up to PTA meetings across America. Connie Chung reported on it on the CBS Evening News. One teacher went on Good Morning America to talk about it. The language being used at school board meetings was devil, seance, witchcraft, occult. A former elementary school teacher said in a 1993 Chicago Tribune interview, if these books were movies, they'd be R-rated because of the graphic violence. There's no moral to them. The bad guys always win.
Well, she was incorrect about that because those books did become a movie and it was not R-rated. Sorry if there's the future stuff.
No, you're right. There's an irony in the fact that, as I said, Schwartz had compiled a sampling of core folklore stories that we've been telling for ages, and modern parents wanted to ban them because they promoted fear of the dark and the good guys don't win at the end of some of the stories.
Mm-hmm.
That's a complaint about the absence of redemptive framing. Folklore has never promised safety. It has always told some truth about what might wait in the dark. And the parents trying to ban the book were trying to keep their children from that.
100, man. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, that is the point of these stories. That's the point of scary stories in general, is like, you should be afraid of the dark. You should be afraid of these things. And that is the reason why we survive so long. But it's funny that, like, in the modern lexicon, in the world of, like, you know, relative safety, we're just like, no, we need to shield them from that because we have such a safe world. But what happens, man? What happens when the dark gets in? You know, you got to be prepared.
Yeah. Shel Silverstein.
Yeah.
Shel Silverstein's A Light in the Attic was published the same year as Scary Stories, 1981, and also ended up on the banned list for the same reasons. Darkness, death, no morals, cannibalism, rebellion against parents. It was the same parents, the same decade, trying to ban both of these books. But Silverstein's darkness comes with a wink. The absurdity softens the edge. Schwartz's darkness comes with Gamble's jarring and unsettling drawings. A pit of despair, where A Light in the Attic kept kind of a safety net. If you took the darkest Shel Silverstein poems, stripped out the humor, and put Gamble's illustrations next to them, that's Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. You can't ban a campfire tale. You can't ban folklore. You can try to ban the book that wrote it down, but it's still out there, shambling through the dark, its grave in its wake, its destination, the next generation. And thank goodness there's always another type of parent. R.L. Stine tells a story in the documentary about the books. He was watching a school board meeting on C-SPAN where a father stood up. This father says he works long hours and comes home with nothing left to give his family. He says to the board, "If you ban these books, I'm afraid my daughter will lose interest in reading and end up like me." He stood in front of them with tears in his eyes and a handful of Goosebumps books, like 10 of them in his hands, holding them up. Behind every kid who devoured these books was often a parent like that, like my mom, who understood that whatever calls your child with a siren song or the groan of a mushy corpse, you allow it.
Damn.
Children discovering these books developmentally need a secret world, a world where their curiosities can be teased without a parent Googling the book title and the words age appropriate. We talked about this a little bit with the point horror of the last episode. Like, this is when you want to put that book in your backpack and not show it to your parents. And it's your own little thing you and your friends can pass around, and it doesn't belong in your parents' hands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is your own thing that you are reading. And I like how also that it seems like we always talk about, like, you know, nowadays, you know, everyone's so soft or whatever. It's like, but back in our day, they were harder. But now, back then, they were also trying to, like, no, we need to shield, you know, pearl clutching from these like books that we loved. And it's so funny to think about that in hindsight, like, look back and like, we love these things. And like, oh, they were uproarious. They were scandalous, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the battle went on for, and probably continues to go on, but for two decades, they were trying to ban and challenge these books so much that they were at the top of the list. Mm-hmm. But these stories don't resolve safely. The hook, that famous story, the killer's still out there. The big toe, the thing that comes for it, gets what it came for. Harold the Scarecrow wins. These are not cautionary tales where virtue is rewarded. They're folk horror. The monster is real, and it does not go away. It's on its way, and it keeps reminding you. The text occasionally goes to a dark place, and the illustrations consistently go somewhere that the text didn't even know existed, beyond what a child's imagination could produce alone. And once you've seen them, you cannot unsee them.
True. They stick with you, man. They stick with you still. It makes me want to go out and get that book, because I had it. It was one of those things, like, I had several of them. Mm-hmm. I don't know whatever happened to, like, books. It's like, you know, you grow up and you move, or, you know, like,
different places. You know, your parents snuck in and took them while you were asleep and burned them in the backyard.
They're like, not here, not this filth, this Satanist stuff. We're getting out of here. Yeah, maybe. Doubt it. Not my folks. They would be like, whatever, he's reading. Like you said, like, it's like, he's reading. That's cool.
Paris. This story is older than the book, older than anyone who ever wrote it down. It was told around fires long before it found its way to the page, and this is my version of it. Deep autumn, the kind of cold that doesn't apologize. There was a farmer who had a daughter he loved more than anything on earth. She was his whole world, and she fell in love with a farmhand named Jim. He was a good man, hard working, but the farmer didn't think he was good enough. So he did what fathers do when they think they know better than their children's hearts. He sent her away, on the other side of the country, to stay with her uncle. That will be the end of it. It wasn't the end of it. Jim got sick, and not long after she left, he stopped eating, stopped sleeping. He wasted down to nothing. Everyone who knew Jim said the same thing. That boy had died of a broken heart. The farmer knew it too, and felt so guilty he couldn't find the words to write the letter to his daughter, letting her know. So he said nothing. Some silences are cowardice dressed up as kindness. Weeks went by. Then one night there was a knock at her uncle's door across the country. She opened it, and Jim was standing there. He said her father had sent him along to bring her home. He was on one of her father's horses that she recognized. She didn't ask questions. She packed a few things, and they rode out into the dark together, her arms around his waist, the two of them gliding across the land like the ground wasn't even there. After a while, he said his head was hurting him, and he felt something terrible. She put her hand on his forehead. Paris, you know what cold clay feels like?
I do not.
Not cold like winter, but cold like mud. Like something that used to be warm and isn't anymore. and won't ever be again. That's what she felt. She took the handkerchief from her pocket and tied it around his head, and they rode on without another word. They made it to the farm before dawn, and she knocked on the door, and her father answered, startled to see her. You didn't send for me? No. She turned around, and Jim was gone. So was the horse. They went to the stable, and the horse was there, covered in sweat, trembling so hard you could hear it. No sign of Jim. And that's when she told her father the truth. They went to Jim's family, and together they all decided to open Jim's grave. The coffin was there. Jim was in it, and tied around his head was her handkerchief. That's the part that gets me every time, not the ghost, not the ride, that handkerchief, because it means he was really there, and it means he came back for her. And her father had to stand there and understand exactly what he had done.
Mm-hmm. Man, I love that. I love that. I like think it's, I mean, it's not necessarily, I mean, it is like a parable a little bit, but it's just not
a ghost story, right?
It is. It's a good ghost story. I was like, it's like a parable for the dad, which is not typical. Usually it'd be like for the daughter, but it's like, hey man, these things happen. It is a good ghost story. It's a good creepy ghost story. And I love the way you read it, Tommy. It was nice.
Oh, thank you. There are consequences for our actions, you know, so that's kind of what I take away. But I find these books to be sheep in wolves' clothing. The stories are tame, docile even, but the drawings, the costume, the packaging, that's where the real danger lurks. There's a scene in the Scary Stories documentary where the woman who led the effort to ban these books sits down with Alvin Schwartz's son in modern day. They talk, and the conversation fades out. The audio and the picture goes black. It all fades to black, and the documentary moves on because that's what happens. The noise fades, the signs come down, the meetings end, people go home, and the books are still there, still in the hands of babes. I read this as a kid before Goosebumps, before Fear Street, before King. It didn't scare me, but it stood out and made its impression. I understood even then that the book was doing something different than anything else on the shelf. With the illustrations and the fun poems, songs, and stories, there was nothing else like this for kids.
I mean, when you look back on it and you remember it, it's like it is fairly like a Shel Silverstein thing. It has a lot of those things, but around such a scary package. But it feels familiar and it feels like it is very accessible. Like it was written for children. Like it's very accessible to, you know, a kid reader.
It is pretty tame. I read the whole thing and I was like, Ella could absolutely read this. I'd have no problem with it. I could read some of these stories to Simon and not have a problem with it. He's five. Like a lot of the stuff in there is just like kind of fun, spooky songs or poems or there's not a lot of what these parents were talking about, Satanism and the occult. Like they're just buzzwords of the time, right?
Minimal Satanism. Yeah.
What I now know that I didn't back then was that I'm not reading a scary book. I'm reading a bit of history dressed up as a campfire story, collected and written in a shed in New Jersey by a folklorist who cited his sources. R.L. Stine, who knew something about writing horror for children, said that Schwartz's genius was taking these folklore tales and writing them in a way that children could easily digest them. He was the translator. He took stories that lived in oral tradition, in regional dialect, in specific cultural memories of communities around America and the world, and rendered them into clean, simple prose you'd find in a children's book. And then Gamel took those simple sentences and drew the thing beneath them, the thing that Schwartz had translated away from, and suddenly the child had access to both versions, the softened and the primal. Gamel really drew the part that history kind of glosses over. So, Paris, what were children getting from these books that offer no safety?
I think it's that the fact that it does not end in a easily buttoned up type of thing. It's like it, but it is the parable. It is like just the thing is just there, and then you move on to the next story. And there's so many different stories in it. Mm-hmm. I don't remember exactly how many there were at the time, but you just read that, you digested it, you're like, oh man, that's how it ended. And then you move on. Mm-hmm. And it's not like, and then everything good happened in the end, which it doesn't always happen like that.
Yeah, I think that folklore aspect made, like, it hooked children. Mm-hmm. It hooked me. It hooked me. I wanted to read every story. I wanted to see every illustration. And when the next one came out, I wanted to get it as fast as possible. But
yeah, because they did three of them, right?
Yeah, there's three. Mm-hmm. But also, I wanted to tell everyone, like all my friends, my whole class, everyone at the daycare, like anyone who would listen, this skeleton came down the chimney or this or that. And it was really continuing that oral tradition in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Where's My Toe thing, like that was a really good one. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh man, that one stuck with me. Oh yeah. God,
all the spiders coming out of the spider bite on the face.
God, the spider one, that was a really good one. Yeah, the scarecrow one was good, but I think the toe one, for me, that one stuck with me. That's the one that still sticks with me. I think it's because when you're a kid, you often do things that like don't make any sense and you're just like, whatever. And you do some like random bit of destruction. Yeah. But the fact that like that comes back to haunt the kid, mm-hmm. And like there's some consequences for it. I think that one was kind of parabolic, and that one like stuck with me a little bit.
A story like the toe, I love. It's one of my favorite ones, but it's so ridiculous. Like a mother's digging in the garden and finds a toe, like a loose toe. And then she washes it off and puts it in a stew. Like it tells, you know, it strikes a chord, I think, in a different time and place when mm-hmm. perhaps your family is struggling to put food on the table. And sometimes you're not entirely sure what you're eating. That kind of thing.
Yeah. Hard times, especially, you know. The economy, you know, you got to add some toast, thicken up the stew.
Yeah. And I mean, that's something that an adult, I think, can pick up on is reading these stories now. You can see their connection to other times and place in history and other fears and communities where stuff was happening that doesn't happen anymore. Things like that. It's a really cool read even now as an adult. In the movies, the documentary is really well done. I recommend it if you're interested in the books. And then the 2019 film, which the story of that film was written by Guillermo del Toro.
Yeah.
And he produced the movie. So mm-hmm. another little mm-hmm. forgotten fiction mm-hmm. connection.
Love it. I love how we're drawing connections now. Now we got a whole spider web of like different stuff going on.
Oh, yeah. It's going to get more and more complex.
The spiral, man.
Have you listened to the new episode of Forgotten Fiction? It's 8.5 hours long.
Yeah. They mostly just reference other episodes of Forgotten Fiction. It's crazy.
It's really starting to fold in on itself. I'm kind of worried about those guys.
Yeah. It's just the logo is just an Ouroboros now. It's just like a snake eating itself. Man. And then they talk about Neverending Story for like a long time because they talk about Ouroboros.
It's weird. And no one knows what happened to them, but their wives say that they're still in the studio talking about the Neverending Story.
To this day.
They've gone really meta.
Well, man.
I've been excited to talk about this story for a long time, and I'm glad that we finally got to get it out there.
Yeah, I wish people, I mean, and we may, I don't know, may do a clip or something, but like the, when you said Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, I was just fist bump in the air. I was like, that's right, Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark.
It's so cool. There's such, I think, cornerstones of children's fiction. They will be on the shelves of my children for sure.
Nice. Keep the tradition alive, man.
Yeah. And keep the tradition of our Patreon alive. Go to patreon.com/forgottenfiction. It's absolutely free. We can all comment, chat, and hang out there. It's really cool.
Please don't forget about us. Follow us on Instagram @forgotten_fiction and send us your forgotten fiction @forgottenfictionpod@gmail.com.
And remember, everything you remember was forgotten.